Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is in the middle of a sushi craze, but it didn't happen overnight. Japan's fabled raw fish on rice first showed up in LA's Little Tokyo in the 1960s, so exotic that it made most Americans squirm at the thought. Then Yul Brynner fell for sushi, the hip crowd picked it up, the taste for seaweed and ikura, maguro and toro, and of course the California roll spread. Today, sushi is all over. Millions of Americans gulp it down with relish, but not so many know what they're really getting into. Up next on Point, a cultural history of the way of sushi. Joining me now from Washington is Trevor Corson. He lived in Japan for 3 years, speaks fluent Japanese. He spent 2 years working as a lobsterman off the Maine coast and came out with the bestseller, The Secret Life of Lobsters. Now he's come back to a first love in his new book, The Zen of Fish, the story of sushi from samurai to supermarket. Trevor Corson, thanks very much for being here.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you, and it's close to my heart, or tongue, or belly. I'm not sure what to say. You made me hungry just reading, but I have to ask in the end, are you celebrating sushi or something else here?
Well, it's certainly a celebration of sushi, but it's also an attempt to look a little bit deeper into the meal because most of us just don't know anything about it. So I was trying to get into the history and the science of all of these bizarre creatures that we eat so that we can come to the sushi bar with a lot more information and be much more informed eaters.
I'm ready for that. How do you describe to people just how big sushi has become, in some ways against all odds, given where it started, how big it's become in this country?
Yeah, really against all odds. I remember the first time I ate sushi and I found it completely repulsive. That was 1986.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that is just most surprising and indicative that I really became aware of in the course of my research for this book was that now there is a whole another wave of sushi spreading into the Midwest. I mean, it's really taking root in the American heartland now. You know, we're accustomed to thinking of sushi as this exotic hip meal in L.A. or New York City, but now sushi places are opening up in Oklahoma, Kansas City, Twin Cities, St. Louis, Peoria, Illinois. Got at least 3 sushi restaurants now.
I hear
so
it all over.
So that, to me, is very indicative.
Yeah, I see here numbers, 9,000 restaurants serving sushi in the United States today. 3,000 retail stores offering takeout sushi. I mean, there was a time, and you describe it, not so many years ago when this just had the tiniest toehold in this country. How did it get started here?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. There were a huge number of Japanese migrant laborers in California in the earlier part of the 20th century, but there wasn't a whole lot of food for them to eat. There was a small Japanese neighborhood in L.A., Little Tokyo, and there were a few food shops and stuff. But it was very hard for them to get into other businesses besides farming, and so because of discrimination. And so a few people who wanted to do some, you know, set up some kind of business, one of the few options for them was to import food from Japan for other Japanese people living in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So there was a company in particular that started doing this. And they realized at some point that to expand their business, they were really going to have to figure out if they could sell something to Americans, not just to their fellow Japanese immigrants. Mm. So a fellow named Noritoshi Kanai began searching for a product that he could bring to America and sell to Americans. And reportedly, there are a few reports that they had tried some things like snake meat and chocolate-covered ants.
Ooh, okay.
and certain kind of cookie. And none of these products really caught on, needless to say. They hadn't even considered sushi because they thought it would be so disgusting that Americans would never agree to eat it. But he was on a business trip in Japan with an American colleague and took the guy out for sushi on a whim, and this American colleague of his fell in love with sushi, and so they decided that's what they would try to sell to Americans. So he came back and helped set up a sushi bar in Little Tokyo, and that was the beginning.
What year was that? 1960 something?
Yeah, it was in the mid-60s, mm-hmm. and mid to late 60s. I think it was 68 maybe, mm-hmm. and it took a while for it to catch on. They started having other Japanese who would come in and eat sushi, but As you said in your introduction, it was really when Hollywood, the people in Hollywood discovered sushi in L.A., that it just exploded. And once you had celebrities eating sushi, there was no getting the cat back in the bag.
Yul Brynner got into it, and then in a later generation, Olivia Newton-John, of all things, and Barbara Streisand and Robin Williams, big sushi eaters. There's also this sort of mark of what bravery, courage, wild abandon for Americans to go and eat raw fish.
Yeah, I mean, it became a kind of a badge of honor, you know, or courage, if you could have said that you ate sushi. And I think that's also part of what's pushed sushi to become so popular in the U.S. even, you know, now. I think this process is still underway in that we love this. We love to be able to find something exotic and different that sets us apart as Americans. You know, we're all about being individuals and finding something unique that we can show off with. And I have a sense, it's just kind of a gut feeling, that that's part of what drives our interest in sushi here.
Of course, these days, on the other hand, it's become such common fare for so many people. I hear people, you know, sort of out and about saying, oh, I'm picking up sushi for dinner, as if they were saying we're getting takeout pizza.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just go to the supermarket and you'll find it there. And the number of supermarket outlets for sushi now is just astonishing. It's a little bit of a shame in one sense, because people now get this idea that sushi is supposed to be cold rice and, you know, sort of gooey raw fish, because that's what you get in the supermarket.
That's what you get when
boxes.
It's not fresh. Trevor, we may know a sushi lover by what he most loves. Get us in here a little bit, very viscerally, into sushi. What are your favorite dishes? Are you an eel guy, you know, toro or uni or California roll man? What are your loves?
Well, I mean, I pretty much started out as an equal opportunity sushi eater. I mean, I would eat anything they put in front of me, and especially when I was living in Japan, the fun of it was not knowing what you were going to get. And that's one of the things I try to encourage people to do in the book, is instead of ordering off a menu, just try talking to the chef and seeing what they have, because you might get some interesting things you wouldn't have thought of trying. But what was interesting for me in researching this book and talking to a lot of sushi chefs and really reading the history of sushi in Japan was that the fish that that we consider so typical of sushi, like the fatty tuna, the toro, fatty salmon, those items actually weren't the popular items in Japanese sushi for a long time. And if you go back, the really popular fish were lighter, leaner fish like flounder and snapper. Those were considered the pinnacle of sushi in Japan. And tuna was actually considered, you know, junk food. And so for me personally, I've evolved in my appreciation of sushi through the course of doing this research. And I've become much more appreciative of the subtler flavors of some of those lighter fish.
Mm. So, but those the glistening little salmon, orange salmon eggs, ikura, or that yucky, mucky sea urchin uni, my least favorite. I don't know, where do you come down across the whole spectrum? Lighter like what?
I you know, sea urchin is a good example of, it might be even one of the best examples of an ingredient that if it isn't really fresh, it almost isn't worth
Run.
Eating. I mean, you can get a sea urchin roe that is just heavenly, you know, it just tastes incredibly fresh, and but it's hard to come by, those are. And so you're always gambling a bit, but I will eat pretty much any piece of sushi. I don't think I've ever turned my nose up at anything, no matter how disgusting it looked, because I just find the experience to be incredibly fun and interesting.
You know, I spent 5 years based in Tokyo and had my favorite sushi bar like almost anybody there would, and some of my most heavenly lunches in all of life were sitting at that little sushi bar in that very intimate setting with the chefs going at it with such precision and gusto and finesse, all at the same time, watching everybody around that clean, well-lit place savoring their sushi, you know, getting the bits one by one. It was very individual, but also kind of a collective joy as everybody took their favorites and the chefs are interacting with the patrons at the bar. What about the American experience of eating sushi these days? How do you see this comparing with how Japanese might be eating it?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you told that little story, because that's exactly what I feel we're missing out on in the U.S. To me, sushi, really good sushi, is not so much about, you know, this particular exact kind of fish or, you know, the very best fish. I think what's so fun about sushi is the social experience of sitting at the sushi bar and getting to know a chef and the interaction that starts to occur between other customers, people you don't know.
Or just the what's moment happened, you walk in the door, irashai mas, you're greeted.
And yeah, right. They scream, they yell out to you and you feel very welcome. And they are boisterous characters, these sushi chefs. And what happened when sushi came to the U.S. is that it kind of got Americanized in the sense that there was more emphasis on sitting at a table and ordering off a menu, and people didn't really know what to do at a sushi bar. I mean, it's kind of intimidating to, you know, go to the sushi bar and not really know how to order or how to talk to the chef or how you're supposed to do it. So we've missed out on that because we do what we normally do when we go to a restaurant. We sit at a table and order off a menu. But it's funny, a lot of the sort of sushi, in-the-know sushi people in L.A. that I talked to when I was researching the book, they told me that when people are always asking them, oh, you know, what's the best sushi right now? Where should I go to get the best fish, the best place? And their answer was always, they would chuckle and they would say, just go find a neighborhood sushi bar where you feel comfortable and go regularly and get to know the chef and let them get to know you and ask lots of questions and make it clear that you're a serious eater and you're interested in what they have to offer. And at that point, that's when you earn the right to start getting their best cuts of fish. I mean, they're not going to give their best cuts of fish to just anybody.
Get close to that chef. Jonathan's calling from Manchester, Massachusetts. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share my experience with sushi here in America. My parents have always had a very international taste with food, and I first experienced it when I was actually 4 years old. And when they took me to the sushi bar, they actually encouraged me to talk to the sushi chef and ended up becoming very good friends with them, and they actually taught me how to make sushi myself. But it kind of spurned an interest in Japanese culture for me, and I actually ended up working and living in Japan for 4 years recently.
Wow, you followed the sushi way to Japan. So when you got there, how did the experience compare with what you've seen and eaten here?
Well, like the gentleman you were speaking with said, I think sushi's been very Americanized here in the restaurant atmosphere. You know, most of the traditional eateries in Japan are these kind of open-air bars where you become very social and get to know the workers and chefs there, and it kind of blew me away. It was very, very different. And I'd say that my most memorable experience there was going to a place called a Kaiten Sushi, which is this sort of air room where they've got a conveyor belt that runs in an S all around the entire room.
Loaded with little plates of sushi.
Yeah, and you can just take what you want. You end up spending $10 or $12 and you just get your fill of this wonderful sushi.
Jonathan, it sounds like you're hooked in for life there. Thanks for sharing that. Let's get another call from Kathy. She's on Route 95 near Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Kathy. I hope you're not eating as you drive.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd just like to say I'm a retired art teacher, and I really love the visual quality of a plate that the sushi chef.
What is it? The color, the glistening fish, the textures.
The arrange. I just like visual. I love to eat it, but visually, I just think they're at a sushi bar or even just making plates. They make such a wonderful display, or they can.
Yes, they do.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, at one point, I was running around the Bahamas in a boat, and we it wasn't sushi, but we'd actually catch the raw fish or a conch and then put lemon juice on it and then let that kind of cook out in the sun. So that's maybe a little more cooked.
Lucky you, running around the Bahamas eating raw conch with a little lemon. It sounds terrific, and we love to be reminded of the visuals. Trevor, take us into some of the history of this dish. I had no idea that it really all starts centuries ago in Southeast Asia on the Mekong River, of all places.
Yeah, the fact that sushi as we know it today exists at all is just quite extraordinary and the result of a series of historical accidents, so we should count our blessings that we even have it. And you're right, it actually started out as a way of preserving fish inland, not near the ocean. Mm-hmm. If you live near the ocean, you don't have to preserve fish.
Just catch another one.
Catch them all the time. Yeah, but there were these rice farmers in Indochina who would get seasonal flooding in their rice fields, and fish would get into their rice fields, and they'd basically kind of perform informal aquaculture, raising fish in their rice fields. But then at the end of the season, they had to drain the fields, and so they suddenly had a big supply of fish, and they would try to, you know, they wanted a way to have them keep for a while so they could eat them later. And so one of the methods they used was actually to pack, they'd gut the fish and clean it, and then they'd pack it in cooked rice. And they used cooked rice because the goal was actually to get the rice to rot. That is what they wanted to have happen, because when rice rots, a series of chemical reactions occur that prevented the fish inside from rotting.
Mm-hmm.
So you would wrap it up in cooked rice and tuck it away in a jar and maybe bury it or something. And this, you know, 6 months or a year later, you could open this up, the rice would smell absolutely disgusting. And one reference in Japan refers to it as smelling like the vomit of a drunkard.
All right.
You would scrape that off, and then you would have this fish that had fermented quite a bit, but was definitely still edible.
They learned to love it then in more or less Vietnam. How did it end up in Japan?
Well, this method for preserving fish spread up through China and then over to Japan. It died out in China. One theory is that because Genghis Khan came in and invaded the country, and they were all meat eaters. They didn't want to eat fish.
Get that stinky fish out of here, right?
Yeah, right. But in Japan, this method was preserved. There's still, in the old city of Kyoto nearby, there's a big lake there, and you can still get this traditional type of sushi there. And then what happened was that people didn't necessarily need to preserve the fish for as long, so they would do this, but they would start eating it earlier and earlier in the fermentation process. And if you eat it early enough in that process, the rice itself is actually still edible. It just has developed a very tangy, sour taste because of the acids.
Now, by the time it becomes really popular, you describe it as Japanese fast food, where in the 19th century, it's not inside, it's on the streets. It's street food in Japan.
Right. And so if you fast forward from that sour rice fish combination up to 1600, the new shogun had unified Japan, built a new city, which would become Tokyo. But in the process of building it, the whole place burned down because of a accident. And so they outlawed hot noodle stands on the street because of the fire hazard. So that was sushi's big chance to go big. And suddenly sushi was this food you didn't have to cook. And exactly as you said, it became the street food. It was basically the McDonald's drive-thru of old Japan in the 1800s.
But some of it got awfully grand. I love this story you share of how in one kind of morals campaign, they outlawed prostitution, pornography, and sushi. Why?
Sushi. Yeah, that was so wonderful. Yeah, they were cracking down on extravagance because they felt that the samurai had lost their warrior skills and were indulging in luxuries. So they went around and rounded up prostitutes, pornographers, and sushi chefs and locked them up.
Because sushi had become like the bribe of choice if you wanted to get to a big public official?
Yes. These very elaborate sushi boxes were being made for various political officials as bribes. And so this was considered something that needed to be cracked down on. Fortunately for us, there was a counter coup, and the original conservatives were ousted, and sushi came back onto the streets.
So it made the leap to Little Tokyo in L.A., picked up by Hollywood, gradually crept across the country. Now Americans eating it like crazy, so much that it's hard to keep up with the demand for sushi chefs. You set yourself down in a sushi school south of L.A., got really close to one young woman, Kate Murray, who we'll hear from in just a moment, and watched her work her fingers to the bone to become a sushi chef much quicker than a Japanese chef would become a chef. But nevertheless, really diving in, what's that experience like?
Well, yeah, that was tremendous. I mean, there's so much interesting information about sushi, but I wanted to present it in the book, you know, as a coherent story. I wanted to tell a story about some characters, some people. And so Kate is a young woman. She's American. She has no knowledge of Asia. She has no cooking experience when she first started this. And I started hanging around with her at this sushi training academy. And she and her classmates, many of whom were young Americans, wanting to become sushi chefs. And I followed them through their entire training, and it was just an extraordinary experience. And Kate's story ended up becoming the focus of the book, and it runs through the whole book. So you're following her development as a person and as a chef through the story, as you're also learning all these other facts. And the training that they went through was a compressed 3-month version of what in Japan would have been something like a 5-year apprenticeship. Mm. And that's what it takes in Japan to do this traditionally. But this sushi academy opened in the U.S. because the guy who runs it, whose story is also in the book, he's a fascinating character. Mm. He was concerned that Americans were embracing sushi so quickly that there wasn't enough training going on to supply the chefs that were necessary. So, and he figured, you know, why not train American chefs? And that's exactly what's happening now. And Kate's a great example. And she really struggled to get through this training course because it was surely the hardest thing she'd ever done. Well, and the instructors were like samurai, I'm sure we'll hear her talking
right,
about it.
Though very international. I mean, you've got the main instructor there just to see how international sushi's become. Her instructor was an Australian-born former bodybuilder of Yugoslav descent teaching Japanese sushi in an American, the California Sushi Academy in L.A. What a picture. We've got her with us right now from San Diego. Kate Murray, hi. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
You made it through.
I did.
You are a sushi chef. You work at Sushi Fix in San Diego.
Right.
That sounds very, speaking to the addiction of sushi with Fix, I guess, and very American. What kind of setting, what kind of restaurant is it, Kate?
Sushi Fix is a place where you can get sushi bar quality food. It's actually a little quicker. It's more for the business lunch kind of thing where you can come in and order and just sit down and get everything at once.
It's like In-N-Out sushi, quick sushi.
Yeah.
Wow. And what was it like spending, 3 months becoming a sushi chef? It sounds pretty grueling at points in the story that Trevor Corson shares.
It was. It was really tough. I was a couple years younger, and I had, like Trevor said, I had no kitchen experience, no knives. All I knew was the steak knife and the butter knife. So when they gave me a big suitcase full of knives, I was a little worried.
But you write about how much you love it. What is it about sushi chefing? I'm not sure what the verb is, that you love.
Oh, man, I just, everything. I just kind of fell into place. It was so challenging at first, but then it kind of clicked, and I loved it. And the sushi just comes together, and I believe it was Kathy before that was saying it's just so pleasing to look at, and it makes you want to eat it. And that's what's fun for me.
And you found you like getting that up close and personal with raw fish every day, all day?
Right.
Wow, it's great. Trevor, you write about, the knife at the heart of all this, the yanagi, means willow, but it's that tapered blade, sort of the shape of a willow leaf that is at the heart of a sushi chef's primary work at the sushi bar. And I guess there you find the link with the samurai that you mentioned in your title.
Yeah, actually, after the Shogun unified Japan, this was following a long period of warfare in Japan, and at some point they finally outlawed samurai swords because it was just too much risk of starting, another round of conflict with people carrying around these giant swords with them everywhere. And so the sword makers had to turn their skills to something else, and they became some of the best knife makers in the world. And, I watching Kate and her classmates learn to deal with these knives, I mean, it's like having a pet almost, because they require daily care. They're incredibly finicky. They'll rust on a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. You have to sharpen and shape them almost every day. And one of the funny things with Kate's story was her sort of coming to terms with her knife and really getting, facing it eventually and learning to deal with it. And it's an incredible relationship that a chef has with his knives. And these are just not, knives in the sense that we think of them. They are almost alive in how full of spirit they are and how much care they require.
Kate, how about that? We're talking here about the zen of all this. The zen of that sushi knife must be a very live one. Why was it hard to get so intimate with the knife, and what have you learned from it?
Well, eventually I learned that it has to be an extension of your arm. You can't think of it as a knife. I don't, at least. Mm-hmm. I just... you want to go with the against the grains of the fish, and I don't know. As soon as you get a feel for it, just gets a little better and a little better. And
Imagine if you had 5 years training on it, as the
right.
Japanese sushi chefs do. But if you stick with the work, you'll eventually have 5 years under your belt yourself.
Right.
Let's go to a caller, Nathan from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What do you know?
Well, I'm a contractor, and through building houses, I've made a lot of customers around the Providence and Newport area.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine is a sushi chef in Colorado and a fly fisherman, and when he comes home in the summer, we throw private sushi parties for some of my customers.
And so does sushi make the business run like water?
The sushi business... for the private party sector that we throw is unbelievable. Everybody that we have over, the person that's throwing the party, all their friends are amazed by it. It's something new. It's something fresh. It's exciting.
And they don't scream and say, gross, raw fish, I'm out of here?
Absolutely not. They bring the sake. We bring the fish. And my friend, when he's working, it's like he's dancing with his knife. The food looks, you know, so appetizing. It's beautiful. The textures are just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and everybody's very, very impressed and always happy whenever they leave, and we always have repeat customers.
It sounds like a lot of happy campers and deals get done. Nathan, thanks for that. Let's go to Evan in Ashland, Massachusetts. Evan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
And Trevor. I just wanted to make some comments, some of which have been touched on, and that is that sushi making in Japan is almost like Budo. It's very tradition oriented, and as you pointed out, takes 5 years, or some of my friends in the business have told me, 3 before they can even pass sushi over the counter.
Yes,
as an apprentice.
To learn the discipline, the zen of it, if you will, the Budo.
And what I've noticed is that 20 to 30 years ago, I live in the Boston area,
mm-hmm.
I could get sushi, good sushi, in many places because there were actual Japanese chefs making the sushi. And now, today, it is really hard to find good sushi. No offense to anyone, but you know, many of the people making it don't have that tradition. They're either, as you pointed out, Americans, some of which I'm glad to hear are getting trained now, and
mm-hmm.
others are Korean and Chinese that don't have that tradition. They're just adding it on to their thing that they do. And it's, although it's more widespread, it's actually quite hard to find good sushi these days.
Evan, you raise a good point, and let me take it to Kate before we lose here. Kate Murray,
yes.
Here you are. You went through it. You took your course, and then you hear that, and it must not be the first time.
Right.
Do you take that as a diss? Do people say, oh, you're not Japanese. How can you be a sushi chef? Do you think that the non-Japanese sushi chef with the time and effort can make it sparkle?
Of course they can. I do it, you know. Every time I make sushi, I always put in something a little extra. I mean, obviously, I'm not from Japan. I didn't grow up with it. But I love it, and I want other people to love it, too. And
what about being a woman? It's traditionally a very male-dominated role in Japan.
Right. That's one of the hardest parts. When I have to find a new sushi bar that I want to work at, you kind of have to win the men over because they're older, they're Japanese, maybe they're Hispanic, you know. And it's hard to come in as a young woman and kind of have to win these men over and let them give me a chance even, you know.
Kate, here's a tip from one of my producers. She said she wants to see an all-girl sushi bar in San Diego. All
right.
Woman, as it were. maybe that's the way. Kate Murray, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Trevor Corson is with us. He came out with The Secret Life of Lobsters not so long ago. Now he's out with a terrific book, The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. And we've got a lot of sushi lovers from right around the world who want to join us. Let's go to Argentina, Buenos Aires. We've got a listener, Jonathan, there online. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Great to have you. What do you know about sushi way down there?
Well, I just want to add my 2 cents into this because basically I've had some of my best experiences and worst experiences eating sushi outside of the U.S. and outside of Japan. So in terms of, you know, having a great chef who's a native or a great chef who's a non-native, I think it really depends on where the restaurant is what their chef is doing.
Is sushi popular in Argentina? You're in the land of great beef there. Is sushi a big item?
It's definitely a big item. You can get sushi delivery down here if you want. And the sushi quality, I mean, it definitely depends on the place where you go and the type of fish. Like down here, they don't have a lot of tuna, so you get mostly salmon. that's imported from Chile.
And are you looking for some kind of guarantee that you're going to get the real item when you walk into a sushi joint, or do you know right away?
Well, you have to go in. You have to check it out. I mean, you look at the fish, you look at the people, and you gotta like the other caller said, and like the author said, you gotta kind of get to know the people as well. So I think that's a good tip to take worldwide. The other comment I wanted to make, and the question that I have, was basically the internationalization of sushi today and the quality going, you know, in all sorts of directions. I read that the Minister of Culture, I think it was trying to certify these restaurants now as being authentically Japanese. And I was wondering if your guest had some comments on that.
Jonathan, in Buenos Aires, keep on loving that sushi, and we'll pick it straight up. Trevor Corson, how about it? We did read something about the Japanese government setting out to, what, give official seals of approval to Japanese restaurants all over the world? What?
Yeah, this came out a number of months ago, and I find it mostly humorous more than anything else that the Japanese government has suddenly decided they're going to go around the world and certify whether sushi is authentic or not.
The Japanese Restaurant Authentication Plan, it's called.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, my feeling about this, which ties into the earlier comments from the other caller and what Kate was saying, is that this whole question of authenticity in sushi is really up for grabs at this point. You know, Japanese chefs, they are steeped in the tradition, but by the same token, a lot of Japanese chefs in the U.S. haven't really made the effort to take American customers seriously. They haven't made the effort to educate them. Sometimes it's a language problem. Sometimes it's a personality problem. So I don't think that Japanese chefs per se have a monopoly on the good sushi experience or the authentic sushi experience. And a great example is the instructor in my book that you referred to, Zoran, the guy from Australia, who, you know, he's not Japanese at all, but he takes the Japanese tradition far more seriously than almost any Japanese chef I ever met.
That's hard to do. Wonderful. It's hard to do. You know the discipline in Japan.
Sometimes. Yeah, he's so good with his customers. He opens them up to new items. He tries to get them to try things that he wants to recommend to them that are more authentic, more traditional, more interesting. So I really think this is up for grabs, and I think the idea of trying to certify restaurants, you know, as authentic or not is sort of ludicrous.
But what about the evolution of sushi that's gone on in the American market, the American palate? What kind of new developments have shown up here?
Well, I mean, part of the problem, and this is something that this is a very practical issue that I do address in the book as well, and it's just that Americans just aren't familiar with the basic etiquette and procedures of eating at a sushi bar. And one of the things I've tried to do on my website, if you go to the zenofish.com, I've got a How to Eat Sushi page. And what I'm trying to do with that is just lay out the basics for eating at a sushi bar so Americans can go and do things in a way that is going to make the chef realize, oh, you know, I can serve them Japanese style. They know what they're doing with these basic logistics.
Like, okay, give us the 101. Yeah, please.
Yeah, well, a really great example is dipping, when you have your nigiri, dipping the fish side in the soy sauce or the rice side in the soy sauce, and whether you use chopsticks to eat it or your fingers. And of course, we all think we're supposed to use chopsticks and we're supposed to dip the sushi in lots of soy sauce, but that's not really
the case
at all. That
is the rice ball at the base of the fish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, most Japanese sushi aficionados eat with their fingers, and they'll just dip a little corner of the fish in soy sauce, not the rice. And the reason I'm describing this is because good sushi, one of the things about it is that it should be packed very loosely. The rice should be packed loosely so that it melts apart in your mouth. So sushi chefs in the U.S., even the Japanese ones, are automatically, every single Japanese chef in the U.S. I talked to said they automatically pack the rice really hard for Americans because Americans are going to use chopsticks or they're going to dip their rice in the soy sauce, at which point the rice will fall apart if they don't dip, you know, squeeze it really hard. So that's a really basic example.
So you're saying use your hands, flip it over, put the fish, not the sushi, rice in the soy sauce. I have to say, in Japan, I've seen people do it both ways, but not many dipping it in so deep that the rice turns into kind of a soup in the soy.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think that there's the same education issues in Japan, too, because sushi has gone from being served in these very expensive, small, elite sushi bars to much more democratized now with these conveyor belt sushi restaurants and stuff that we heard about. So, you know, there are all kinds of people are eating sushi in Japan that didn't necessarily eat sushi before either. I mean, it's easy to think that sushi's, you know, this widespread thing that everybody in Japan eats, but a lot of Japanese people have exactly the same questions and hang-ups and insecurities about eating sushi as Americans.
Let's hit some other points here. California roll and spider roll and rainbow roll and all those that sort of came out of the American sushi years. Have those been picked up in Japan? Are those seen as a corruption of sushi or as a welcome addition?
Yeah, well, rolls in general are really not part of traditional sushi at all. And the rolls in if you went to a Japanese sushi bar, they would serve you a bunch of nigiri, the little packs of rice with fish on top. And then maybe at the end, just to make sure you were full, they might make you a very simple roll with a little seaweed around it and some tuna or something inside. But yeah, the rolls have exploded in the U.S., all kinds of elaborate, complicated rolls with bizarre ingredients and stuff have really taken off here in the U.S. And yes, to answer your question, some of these rolls have now been imported back into Japan as American-style sushi. And there are now restaurants in Japan that serve so-called, what they call it, creative sushi or American-style sushi, in which they'll serve these rolls. And they're just sort of a curiosity for Japanese people to go to these restaurants and experience American-style sushi.
Stick that in your futomaki. Let's go to our callers. We've got a long line around the sushi bar here. Joan is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. You know?
Two things. Yeah. I first learned to eat sushi my first day in Japan in 1967 when
welcome.
I was welcomed into a family who didn't really want to put on a big feast but wanted to give me an authentic Japanese experience. Mm-hmm. So they sent out to a restaurant that actually made this up, and I learned two things that evening, how to eat sushi and how to drink sake.
maybe the second was necessary to the first if it was your first time.
That was the way the family did it, and it was wonderful. I never looked back.
Yeah,
I have one question.
Yeah.
I noticed that there has been no mention, or at least I haven't heard any mention, of chirashi sushi, which is sushi, it's rice in a box, and all of the fish, the vegetables and whatnot are put on top of it, decorated, and served to you that way. You very seldom see it in the U.S., although I tended to see it off and on when I was in Japan.
Trevor, what do you say? Chirashi sushi?
Yeah, the word sushi actually refers simply to the rice that's been seasoned with vinegar, sugar, and salt. So any combination of any ingredients that involves that rice is sushi. And in Japan, there are regional varieties of sushi across the board. The sushi we know is just Tokyo-style sushi.
Mm-hmm.
So chirashi sushi is another example of a type of sushi, but it's certainly under the sushi umbrella.
But there you'd have a lot delivered in one packet. I mean, in general, in Tokyo anyway, you're much more likely to get this a piece or two at a time, not the kind of full spread that we tend to lay out in the restaurant setting of many American sushi bars.
Right, exactly. I mean, this experience of eating at the sushi bar Tokyo style is really based on the chef standing right there and delivering pieces of sushi to you one by one rather than getting a whole bunch at once. And chirashi sushi is like great for picnics and outings and stuff. You just spread a bunch of rice in a box and sprinkle all kinds of toppings on it and go and eat it that way, much simpler and easier.
I want to bring one more voice in here for a moment, if I may. Joining us from Beverly Hills, California, is Jeff Nitta. He's a partner and director of operations for Hokusai, a new Japanese restaurant in Beverly Hills on Wilshire Boulevard. They just got rave reviews from the Los Angeles Times. Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Trevor. How are you?
Hey, Jeff. Good.
We're all great. You also, in addition to the restaurant, Hokusai launched and run this outfit called Zero Sushi, placing sushi chefs across the country. What's the demand like these days,
yes,
Jeff?
I just saw a need for sushi chef placement because of the expansion of sushi across the country and globally. As you have the callers from Argentina, I've had calls from Russia to Barcelona, all over the world.
So do you get your chefs from Japan, or are they fresh out of the sushi academies of California?
Both. And it all depends on what the client needs. And so what I try to do is adapt to the client's needs.
And where are you getting requests from these days? From Dubuque?
Right now, it's really interesting. And I just wanted to make a point here, Tom and Trevor, thank you so much for, Trevor's book is educating the consumers. And your show, and it's just wonderful. Listen, and Trevor's answers to all these questions are unbelievable. They're right on. And so that just helps what I do tremendously.
So what about the people you're sending out? I mean, Kate Murray went in, and she struggled at it, and now she's got a job. But it was, at the end of the day, 12 weeks of training, not the years that Japanese sushi chefs get. So from a consumer angle, you know, can we be getting anything like the same thing when it's 12 weeks and out compared to years before you even get to pass sushi across the counter?
Yes. For example, I did place Kate at her first job there. And again, I was trying to find somewhere that she can find somewhere where she can begin. But when they come out of school, they want to be the sushi chef. They want to be the star right away. And it's going to take a while to get there. As you can see, Kate is moving up the ladder, per se. And that's where you're going to start seeing this expansion. As Kate keeps learning and honing her skills, she will definitely become one of the masters chefs out there and probably be respected. I think that's the wave of the future.
Trevor, I want to hit a couple of things, and with Jeff here, before we lose you, first, on health, many Americans have looked to fish as a source of healthy diet. What do you say about sushi? I mean, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, it tastes great, but is it health food?
Well, I mean, sushi in general isn't really health food in the sense that it's got plenty of carbs and everything in it that, you know.
And sugar and whatever
sugar,
else is in the fish.
A lot of sugar, a lot of sodium. But, you know, I mean, certainly like things like the seaweed are full of vitamins. And I think in moderation, there are a lot of advantages to it. It's just not, you don't be expecting that you're going to be cutting calories by eating sushi. And the question of the fish, you know, I mean, this is a question regardless of when and where you eat fish and what type of cuisine. You always want to be aware of the fact that the salmon and the tuna are probably going to be higher and potentially in mercury and PCB and that kind of thing. And what really struck me was that it's the traditional fish of Japanese sushi, the lighter flesh fish, the leaner fish, the flounders, the snapper, those fish, which were really the focus of traditional sushi, those are actually environmentally better and health-wise they're better to eat too.
And then, of course, there's the question of the fish and just how many we can gulp down. Bruce is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I just want to float it out to see if Trevor did much research on the decline of the giant bluefin, thanks to our seemingly insatiable appetite for toro.
Yeah, the bluefin tuna, which has been fished like crazy. What about Trevor?
Yeah, that's definitely a subject I touch on. With each of the fish that the students work on at the Sushi Academy as they go through the story in the book, I try to talk a bit about each fish and what the environmental issues are, what the biology of the fish is. There's some wonderful, amazing facts to learn about all these creatures, and the decline of bluefin is a huge issue, and I'm very concerned about the ranching operations of bluefin that have started to supply year-round regular supplies of fatty tuna. So I don't have a huge agenda with this book. It's basically just trying to teach people a bunch of things that they can take away themselves, but what I do hope is that people will become more aware of the ramifications of each different kind of fish and be able to make better choices.
Tiger Nakawake is Jeff Nita's partner at the Hokusai restaurant. And Jeff, I believe today, this morning, he's been out at LAX at the airport in LA waiting to pick up a really big special free-range tuna. What is that?
Yes, Tiger wanted to be on the show, but he needed to get there to pick up this Kindai bluefin tuna. Just like Trevor said, that the concern now is of the depletion of this tuna. And this university has been working on this project with Nick Sakagami, who's one of the biggest, largest tuna distributors in the country. And this Kindai bluefin tuna, we tested it and we tried it. It's almost like free-range chicken.
How do they raise it? What does it mean to have a free-range tuna?
It's about sustainability. Just like Trevor said, they're trying to find a way to eliminate the ranching per se of people just feeding whatever type of pellets into mm-hmm. these fish and not letting them roam free and all these stuff. And this university has discovered its way, and they spent a lot of years trying to find a solution for this, as what Trevor was talking about. And we are serving that we're one of the only restaurants in the United States serving that right now, is this Kindai bluefin tuna.
Well, good for you. I hope Tiger gets it picked up, packed and nice, and on its way. Jeff Nita at Hokusai Restaurant in Beverly Hills, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Trevor.
Take care, Jeff.
And Trevor Corson, finally, are we going to eat our way right out of this sushi passion? I mean, can we hear so much about the pressures on fish stocks around the world? Can we, you know, can everybody take on the sushi-loving China, U.S., and all the rest and still have the fish to eat?
It's It's a great question, and I don't know that there's a clear answer. And I think, unfortunately, it's conceivable that we're living in a particular moment in history here where we're able to eat all these wonderful varieties of fish and the volume that we do. And I don't know whether we'll be able to continue doing that. And I just think that there's a lot of options out there for the choices you make when you choose your fish and sushi, your ingredients. There's fascinating shellfish, delicious shellfish to eat that aren't anywhere near as endangered as any of these big fish. So I'm hoping that from the book, people will be able to make more informed choices that will hopefully let some of these fish stick around for a while longer.
And help us work the whole breadth of the sushi bar. Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish. It's been wonderful, fascinating, and I've worked up a gigantic appetite. Think we better go and take care of that. But thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.